Seaweed. Well, it's not really a weed at all, but a valuable part of the marine environment and increasingly our diets and our economy. I'm Suzanne Lang, and it's a novel idea. Susan Hand Shetterly has lived on the coast of Maine for most of her life. She has written 9 books, including the award-winning Settled in the Wild. Shetterly has written about wild lands, wildlife, and now writes about the wild ocean in Seaweed Chronicles, A World at the Water's Edge. We'll speak with Susan in just a minute. Seaweed isn't really a weed. In fact, it is not a plant at all, more of an aquatic algae. Phycology is the study of algae, and later in the show we'll talk with phycologist Marilyn Cannon, who has specialized in studying these unique life forms. It turns out that seaweeds have a complex and unusual sex life. So stay with us, it's a novel idea. Is an elemental part of life. Can seaweed expand its role as critical provider and help fight climate change and enhance local economies? Recently, I spoke with Susan Hand Shetterly from her home in Maine, where she continues to explore the virtue of wild. Let's listen to our conversation. Susan Hand Shetterly, your book, Seaweed Chronicles, A World at the Water's Edge. I'm talking to you from the west coast of California, the north coast here, where we have our own issues with our ocean environment here. But it's what drew me to your book and the Gulf of Maine, a place that I don't know a lot about. But I was so interested in finding out about the challenges faced there. And that's your aquatic environment. And so what drew you to writing about seaweed and the integration of it with life in the water and life on land?
Well, to be honest with you, I consider myself an essayist. And this is a book of chapters. So I was putting together what I thought was a very intriguing book of essays, and reading the titles that were the subjects that I thought would be good to my agent. And she was very quiet. It was on the phone. And very quiet is probably very good. And so I came up to wanting to write an essay about a woman I know who's a seaweed harvester. And I wanted to go out and spend the day with her. And she said, "Oh, that's just wonderful. Write a whole book about seaweed." And I thought that was impossible because there wasn't much there. But I started to look around just to prove her wrong, really. And this is almost 5 years later, and the book has come out. In other words, there's an awful lot to write about seaweed, especially the way I've tried to do it, which is talking about seaweeds and what they are, and bringing then the overlay of wildlife and how wildlife needs them and uses them, and then about the coastal people who have lost their fisheries here, and other coastal people who have been my tutors, really, for the last 5 years. I mean, I've been an apprentice, and they've been patient, smart teachers, and they're in the book.
a lot of good stories in the book about your teachers there. And we hear about the acidification of the ocean, the rising temperature in the ocean, the deoxygenation in the ocean, and declining fisheries. We hear a lot about the coral reefs and the life they support and what their decline means. But we don't often hear about seaweed and its integral part in the ecosystem, especially the nearshore ecosystem. And I think some of us, especially on the West Coast here, we may not intimately know about the fisheries in the Atlantic, but I think we all know that there's been declining fisheries in the North Atlantic. And you seem to draw all of this together with kind of our human behavior and then the real necessity of having this complete ecosystem. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I didn't know that in the beginning, as I've said to you. And the reason I know that now is because of not only my studying about it, but it's so interesting to me that when I decided to write this book, I thought, I'm writing this book for people like me. It's not that people who love seaweed shouldn't read it. They can learn a lot of the science and a lot about the people and animals in it. But I wanted to write it for somebody who might say, seaweed, now why does that interest me? And what is there to say about it? So it was sort of like finding an audience like myself. So I tried to lure people in with stories that start out not in the center of seaweed and center of science, but to the side a little bit, if that makes sense. In other words, islands and how sheep have been pastured in islands in Scotland and Ireland and off the coast of Maine, and how those sheep really need kelps to live, and those sheep end up being very, very healthy. Also, I've brought in smaller fish that are anadromous. They swim up fresh water and then they swim back to bays, and they feed other larger fish, and they need seaweeds for habitat. So I'm starting to put these little pieces. It's like a puzzle that I was putting pieces into to make a picture. And the thing that surprised me was the long reach seaweed has, because we think of it as an inshore thing, and it obviously provides protection and food for a lot of very small creatures. But those small creatures feed larger creatures, which feed larger creatures, and you begin to see it, according to the scientists, moving out beyond our bays into deeper water. As a matter of fact, I just went on a whale watch yesterday, and we were way out in the Gulf of Maine. And there were these long, long ropes of seaweed that had been pulled loose from the shore. And those, well, they did have plastic in them, unfortunately, but they also were crammed with little shore creatures that were brought out into the deeper water, which fish and birds will eat. And those in turn, the fish anyhow, will become food for some of the whales we saw. We saw a lot of humpbacks out there. So it looked pretty healthy from our boat yesterday, even though we know there's a lot of stuff going on that we have to do better with, if we can.
Lucky you that that's where you spent yesterday.
I know. I was so lucky. You're right.
I loved the way you actually opened the book with a glossary, which often you find at the end of books. And immediately I saw some terms that I knew. And I think some of us maybe, you know, have certain supplements in our diet that are derived from seaweed, or we eat Asian food or sushi and it has seaweed as a component. But then I started thinking, well, you know, I've not really ever thought much about seaweed. So it was a real revelation to I've encountered it washed up on the beach, and you talk a lot about that as a resource for animals. And you mentioned you have a whole chapter called Flat Island that is about this sheep ranching, I'll call it, on an island. And it really struck me that there are people making their living doing sheep ranching on islands in the Gulf there, that the animals themselves, the sheep, they're providing wool, they're providing meat, but they have an existence that is maybe more natural, I want to say. They're not fenced in. They have access to grazing. They have access to this seaweed that washes up that supplements their diet. And that maybe that wool and that meat, let alone the livelihood made from it, is somehow all better for us than industrial raised animals. And I don't know, it just struck me at the scale of it as well. And in your book, you do talk about people making a living off of the sea or in this aquatic environment as the sheep ranchers do. And it seems like it will take a lot of will to have sustainable fisheries and sustainable agriculture and aquaculture that provides people a livelihood. And in fact, it might even be threatened in the Gulf of Maine by more industrial type seaweed harvesters.
Well, you're a good reader of my book. Thank you very much. I mean, it is true. If you know, you write a book and then you let it cool off a little bit and you start taking a look at it and saying to yourself, now I think I know what this is about, but let's see what I really wrote. And obviously, I do have a certain prejudice because I have lived here on the coast for most of my life and I've seen one fishery after another go bust. And I've seen people having a hard time making a living. So, of course, that influences how I think. And what you're talking about is the same thing I really think is the best way to do things. Can we do them this way? I don't know. But it's individual, independent people out doing either raising sheep or harvesting seaweed with a machete knife and then hanging it on something that looks like an industrial-sized clothesline to dry and then selling it as food. All these jobs that people can do with a sense of hard work and freedom and also intelligence. You know, I mean, a lot of these coastal people have learned so much from the ocean. And it gives people a sense of respect to learn from the ocean, well, or from any wild place, and to harvest carefully, you know, and to make a living that's not too slim. But, you know, one thing I like about the Sheep Island thing, especially, is their clock is not daytime and nighttime, the sheep. You know, they don't go up on the at the top of the island. Well, the island's pretty flat, but away from the shore during the night necessarily. They are tuned to the tides. And so they'll be going down and clattering down on those long, rocky shorelines to find the kelps that have washed up and to eat them. And they'll do it in the dark. And you can imagine, I mean, in Maine, they'll do it in a storm. And that's not an easy thing to do, but they do, and they thrive. You're right about that. They do thrive. Not they wouldn't on every island, but the shepherd knows how to pick a good island. Yeah.
And it struck me, if I recall, that the shepherd that you he took you out to the island with him, that he was a young man. And
You're getting this a little bit mixed up. It was a woman who was the shepherd on Flat Island, and she's in her early 60s. I know what you're talking about. You're talking about the young man who took me out to another island, and he's a kelp harvester. Yeah.
I think I was struck in that case that it was a young man who was able to make a living working with others and providing for himself and in this industry that, I don't know, I was just struck that it wasn't the old ways, is what I want to say. Somebody who has been around and, you know, a salty sea sort, but that there are young people coming into this and bringing their energy as well, and that's a hopeful thing.
Oh, I agree with you. That's completely what I wanted to show. And here's to just extend that thought just a bit further, is that he didn't want to go to college. I don't know if you remember that. He said that wasn't for him. So he went around and learned from people who were doing things that he thought were interesting. And when he got around to hearing about seaweed and harvesting it, he went immediately to one of the people on the coast of Maine who has the best reputation for teaching young people how to do it. And he learned all he could. And then he also has been an independent learner. And I love it that he knows so much, and he taught himself, and he did not go to college, and he works so hard, and he produces a beautiful product, you know? So college isn't for everyone, but isn't that nice that people who choose something else can see their returns and their sense of themselves enlarged and deepen as they grow? I think it's wonderful.
And that the learning is at a very elemental level of the rhythms of our planet and the rhythms
of nature.
You're absolutely
right there. He knows so much about tides, about seasons, about how to look for the healthiest kelps. I mean, there is, in his head, so much information. And I also wrote about a woman who does the same thing. And she tried college. She went to Hampshire, I think, for about 3 semesters and said, nope, don't like it. And she worked in fisheries, and she eventually now owns a seaweed business and goes out and harvests, often on her own and often in the winter.
You use some terms, and just a moment ago you used the term wild, and in your book you use a term, the wild commons. And I wonder if you could explain to our listeners what you mean by the wild commons.
Well, I think you're right, and I think I owe my readers and listeners an explanation of my definition of wild, because it's something that's being argued over quite a bit in this country these days, that word. And what I mean is that we still have habitats which are combinations of animals and what they need to eat and what they need for shelter that are still working. Now, they're probably not working perfectly because of our intervention, one way or another, but they're still working. And so they haven't gone through like the crash of the codfish here in the Gulf of Maine, which are now commercially extinct. So that's what I mean. I put a lighter definition on wild systems than a lot of other people do. Other people, when they talk about wild systems, often say there are none left because human beings have touched them, have altered them. And I'm saying they've been altered, but they still produce, perhaps not 100%, but maybe 70, 60. And that's what I want to talk about, how to bring them back, how to maintain what they have and not lose any more, or if we've lost too much, how to let them go. Here's something that is very troubling. I occasionally like to eat codfish, and about 2 years ago, I don't eat it anymore, but about 2 years ago, I went and I bought some from our local fishmonger, and as he was wrapping it up, I said, now, did this come from the Gulf of Maine, or are we talking about you know, up around Iceland. And he said, oh, no, this is from the West Coast. And here I was standing, what, a mile away from water, which used to be one of the most giving waters on the face of the earth. And I was about to eat a California cod. It just really got me.
Yeah, there's something that seems wrong about that.
There is something wrong about that.
Maybe you could also explain what you do well in the book is the relationship between kelp, which are a seaweed. Kelp is a type of that, and seaweed is a type of algae that I think you refer to, or in my notes I at least wrote down, maybe I was describing it for myself as a multi-celled organism, just using the term organism. And to me that illustrated that there are life forms on our planet and there are life forms in our oceans that function in a way that we terrestrial folks maybe don't always understand, but that these multi-celled organisms that we're calling kind of generically seaweed, they hold a real critical place in the wild oceans. And especially there's this relationship that you describe between seaweed, small macroinvertebrates, sea urchins and crabs and fish, and how when the balance isn't quite right, things go awry.
The thing that I think is so important for us to start with as human beings is to understand that we don't really understand our oceans, that we're beginning to see that we have to see beneath the water. And, of course, how do we do that? Because most of us spend most of our lives looking at the top of the water. But we can do it through scientists and photographers, and they give us a vision into the water and the life in the water. Of course, we can also go down into the water ourselves and do some diving. But here's the thing. Seaweeds, there are two kinds. The seaweed itself, there are two kinds of algae. Seaweeds themselves are called macroalgae, and that just means big algae, of course. And then there's microalgae, and that means little algae. And those are one-celled phytoplankton that float on the top of the water, zooplankton, phytoplankton. And what they're doing is the phytoplankton is absorbing sunlight and making food and putting in little puffs of oxygen out into the air. The seaweeds along the shore are doing the same thing. And scientists believe that actually this is how we first got oxygen into our atmosphere so all other life could follow from it, is from these small microalgae floating on the surface, miraculously, really, on the surface of oceans for thousands, millions probably of years. So they are very ancient. And perhaps they are just, you know, the base, a base from which life develops. And what we find we need in our bodies as far as food is often found in very cleanly grown seaweeds. I mean, some of the minerals, some of the vitamins, some protein. But, of course, seaweeds aren't the only things that are important in the ocean. And we have got to take a close look at what we're doing to mangrove swamps and coral reefs, eelgrass beds and seagrass savannas, as well as seaweeds, because they are the base. You know, it's one person in my book said, well, we're eating down the food chain. We ate the big fish, then we ate the smaller ones, then we ate the smaller ones, and now we're eating seaweed. We have to be careful.
And you do talk about companies coming in from Canada to do more of an industrial kind of harvesting of seaweed.
Right.
And that actually it does make a difference how seaweed is harvested if you want to keep seaweed growing, and that when you have these mass kind of harvests, it may really create a problem for the continued growing of seaweed and hence the continued harvesting of it. But we also see around the world large, would you call them farms of seaweed?
Yes,
type?
Aquaculture farms.
Yeah.
Yep. What you just said about the industrial harvest and everything is somewhat true. And I have a tendency to think that we have to be careful that big industry doesn't come in and take over independent individuals who want to have a small business. On the other hand, we need all kinds of jobs here along the coast. So I understand that the people also are endangered. It's not just the codfish, but it's the way of life that the people used to do. Of course, the reason they're endangered now is because of overfishing. That's probably, 90% of it. But of course, we don't know. I'm just making a guess there. But of course, now our oceans are changing. The Gulf of Maine is warming faster than most other bodies of water in the world because the currents are shifting and changing now. The aquaculture ventures that you mentioned have always gone on in the Pacific Rim, Philippines, Japan, China. Some of those farms are absolutely enormous. I was told by somebody that you can see them actually from space. They're so big. And the Chinese and the Japanese and the Filipinos know how to make a beautiful product. On the other hand, there's always this problem of nutrients. Because if you have an enormous farm, let's say, and you are not, you're packing the seaweed too close together, or you've put it in a bay where there's not a good current to bring in nutrients and clean water, you're going to have a less healthy product. Or, of course, this would be the worst case scenario if you were growing it near places that had a certain amount of pollution, then you'd have a problem.
Yes.
The thing about the Gulf of Maine is because we're just starting our seaweed industry, we've had little independent seaweed harvesting businesses around for the last 30 or 40 years, but they've been pretty small. And now there's a lot more attention on it and a lot more aquacultural endeavor. And the people who are doing the aquaculture, I'm so impressed with them. Because they never cited over wild-growing seaweeds. They always cited over mud bottoms in a clean bay. And we have enormous tides. And so the flushing and the bringing in of clean, nutrient-rich water is going on twice a day here. So they're learning how to grow seaweeds the best they can. And it's a new endeavor here. It's going to be interesting to see how they do it, and I hope they're not taken over by, huge industrial projects.
You say in your book that the more we perfect our capacity to harvest wild nature, the closer we come to destroying all we seek. And it sounds like in the Gulf of Maine, where there's already been the loss of this amazing cod fishery, possibly from the overfishing, that maybe with the seaweed, there maybe is an attempt at a different approach to it.
Yep, I think you got the idea there, and that's why it's so interesting to have been writing this book at this time. Because people do say, well, we got a lot of things wrong. How do we do this right? Of course, the question is, 10 years down the road, will we be doing this really well? And I hope the answer is yes. But people in Maine are asking themselves, okay, we need to self-correct. How are we going to do it starting with the seaweed? Where else do we start? I mean, there are a lot of ways we could fish better, I'm sure of that. But this is new, And so if we can put in place some kind of policies, and we're trying to do that, that protect both the resource and the seaweed harvester. I know it sounds like an impossible thing to do both at the same time, but we have to figure out how to do that. And that's what we're wrestling with here.
And maybe in your part of our country, in Maine there, in the Gulf of Maine, maybe there is the right alchemy of people, of human resources, and recognition of your aquatic resource, that maybe you'll be able to achieve that and be a lesson to other places on the planet as well. One could only hope. You have so many just lovely stories in your book, and the stories of people you encounter there. And for those of us who don't know much about that part of our country, I just want you to maybe quickly tell us a little bit about Down East Maine. I had to look that up. And tell us a little bit about Down East Maine, and really, you know, the Gulf of Maine geologically is kind of interesting, yeah, in that it was formed by glaciers. And because of where it sits in the Atlantic, there is this kind of roiling and mixing of currents. So give us your take on the Gulf of Maine.
Well, would you like me to read my first page of my introduction, which talks about what I think the Gulf of Maine, Down East Maine, means to me?
I'd love it. I'd love it.
Thank you. Down East Maine, where I live, is for me the most beautiful place on earth, even in February, even on a dark day in a sharp wind. It is ledge and cobble, spruce and white pine, mudflats that glisten like a harbor seal's wet pelt, low-tide rocks covered in layer upon layer of seaweeds, and horizon straight east across the water into sunrise in Canada. No frills. It has been for me, and I think for so many others who live here, William Blake's grain of sand, a teaching place, and we've learned something of the world from it. Within the wild fabric of this shore, in its many coves and bays, seaweeds and other lives, from barnacles to fish to birds, are bound together as they are along the shores of other places in the world. It is a tightly woven warp and woof of life, an ancient and essential system of give and take. That's what it is. That's the beginning of my book.
Susan Hand Shetterly, Seaweed Chronicles, A World at the Water's Edge. Is there something you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Yes. I have been reading a lot about the Pacific Ocean along the California coast and up into Alaska, and I want to say that it is an astonishingly rich and wonderful place, and California does so many things right, it seems to me. I know I live very far away from it, but the stories that I've read about the bull kelp and the, let's see, what is it called, the giant kelp, and how they supply these wonderful forests of seaweed that are equal to, yes, the redwoods, and how much, yes, life comes to them. And also, you have so many interesting scientists studying the ocean there. I'm very proud of the west coast of our country and the things that you're trying to get right there.
Yes, we do have the wonderful kelp forests, and Monterey Bay is an incredible resource. And right off the, we're here north of San Francisco, and we have the Cordell Bank off the coast here and off the coast of Point Reyes. That is an incredible ecosystem.
Yeah.
And I agree, we are very fortunate, and As where you live, we face the same struggles of balance, and I think that it is going to take fine books like yours and fine people like the people you represent, and all of us kind of having an awareness of how this is all integrated, and it comes down to us and our lives and the choices we make as well.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So I hope you visit California one day and you visit us, and I hope to visit your beautiful part of our country as well.
Please do come. It will be nice to have you. Thank you very much.
We've been listening to my conversation with Susan Hand Shetterly on life in and around the Gulf of Maine, and her book is Seaweed Chronicles, A World at the Water's Edge. Let's take a short break, and when we return, we'll talk more about seaweed.
Over the years, you have been hunted by the men who threw harpoons, and in the long run, we will kill you just to feed the pets we raise. Put the flowers
Here on the West Coast, we have a tremendous marine environment, and we have an accomplished phycologist living right in Forestville, California. I spoke with Marilyn Cannon from her home, and we were surrounded by books and specimens that she has collected from all over the world. Pressed between paper, I was surprised by the variety of form and by their delicate beauty. Marilyn Cannon, you are a phycologist right here in Sonoma County. And how long have you been studying seaweed, and how did you get into that?
Okay, well, the first class I ever took at Sonoma State University was plant physiology, because I thought I wanted to do something with plants, and I hadn't finished my bachelor's degree, but I was close. So then I really liked the professor, Dr. Chris Kelson, and so I took another class from him the next semester called Nonvascular Plant Morphology, which was all about the so-called lower plants, like algae and mosses and fungi, which aren't really plants. Neither are the algae, for that matter. But that's when I started just really loving it. And so, as you see, I went to this international conference in Newfoundland. So I've been to quite a few different conferences, and I kept studying it. I got my master's in it. I went to Hawaii to study seaweeds. So it's been, a long time. 30-something years? Yeah.
So here in California, right on the California coast, we think of course, the kelp forests in Monterey, I think, is something we all maybe know about because mm-hmm. of how they say, oh, that's like the underwater redwoods. And why do they say that about that kind of kelp?
Well, for one thing, they're so large. I mean, there can be some that are 200 feet long and then have some more floating on the surface. And some of them can grow a foot a day. Now, that's not like a redwood, but I think it's because they're just so massive is why they call them the redwoods of the sea. There's some off of our coast here, too, in Sonoma County. I mean, there's like the big Macrocystis, which is one that's farmed for all kinds of algal products, from putting in ice cream to shampoo to conditioners. It's not farmed here. Like you said, it's farmed more towards Southern California.
So the kind of commercialization of kelp or seaweed, and we know they're not plants, they're multicellular organisms, and they have such utilitarian use and historically have. I mean, people mm-hmm. have been harvesting them for a very long time. And as you say, the components of them are in a lot of products that we use every day. Mm-hmm. But I have to wonder about our general exploitation of what's in the water and our trying to commercialize it. Yet these are active habitats. So I guess I just wonder the implications of this sort of thing.
A lot of the farming of algae or marine algae, also known as seaweeds, has been taking place in Japan for probably thousands of years. And they use bays, and they actually put pieces onto structures so that it'll grow. And so then they harvest it. On this coast, we're basically taking, as you said, right out of the habitat. However, having said that, I have to say that the species that I studied for my master's degree, one reason I was asked to study that is because it's in the same genus as the one they grow in Japan for nori, which is used in sushi and miso soup, and probably almost everybody has had that. So then the thing is, people say, oh, it has commercial value, then they want you to study it. So it's sort of like, okay, we don't want to hurt the environment, and yet they're saying study this because it does have commercial value. And then when you write up your papers, you say, oh, and this has commercial value. But I do have a problem with using the marine environment like that. And there's been a lot of controversy about that over the years on our coast, because there's something called sea palm. It's an annual plant, and a lot of people like to go out there and harvest it. It's a kelp. It's about 2-3 feet tall. But I didn't know that I liked that, because you're going ripping these things, off the rocks. And in addition to that, when you look at how the holdfast, which I think you probably read about in that book, it's a ecosystem in itself. It's got snails and worms and other algae growing on it. So you rip it apart, you're taking, that too and destroying their home.
I also wonder about the ability of seaweed to filter pollutants out of water, out of seawater, and also then, what are the implications for us eating that or having it as nutritional supplements mm-hmm. if it is filtering pollutants? So what is the whole process there in the organism, and what are the implications for then us who might be eating it?
Right. Well, they definitely pick up things from the environment. That's true. One thing is they're high in iodine, which some people like because you know, they want to make sure they have enough iodine in their diet. But some things aren't really even that great for us, like carrageenan. I don't think eating a lot of that is so healthy. It's a protein. It can interfere with different other proteins in your body or enzymes.
Let's just say that, let our listeners know that carrageenan is...
Yeah, it's a cell wall compound from the rhodophyta, which are the red algae, which we see along the coast here a lot. And sometimes they look kind of purplish or brownish, dark brown, not like the kelps, which look more like a brown color. But they're the so-called red algae, and they're the ones that have carrageenan. And they are also, when you say harvested for their carrageenan, regularly.
Let's get back to seaweed and what it actually contributes to the marine environment. And here off the California coast, we have a rich marine environment. And what role do different types of seaweed play in that marine environment?
All right. Well, they have a really important role. First of all, they're the primary producers, which means that they take sunlight and turn it into food, just like land plants do. And so there would be nothing in the ocean, like animals of any kind, if it wasn't for the seaweeds. So they're the bottom of the food chain. So anything that eats them then will be eaten by something else and by something else, but it all came, the energy all came from the sun as trapped by the seaweeds. So you wouldn't want to, you know, wipe out the seaweeds for sure.
Are they mainly growing near the coast, or are there seaweeds that are... Well, I know sargassum is a type of seaweed that floats on the water, but is it mainly a coastal phenomena that seaweed are close to the coast?
It is mainly a coastal phenomenon. I mean, around islands, around the coast here. Sargassum is a special topic in that there's the Sargassum Sea out in the Atlantic. However, there's also sargassum that is attached. I mean, there are several species in Hawaii, and some of it has been brought over here and has been moving up the coast. So it's sort of like, you know, an introduced seaweed. Some people are not that happy about it.
So what are really threats to seaweed here in California or globally?
I think pollution is a problem. That can wipe out some seaweeds. If you go into some bays where there's lots of boats coming in and out, you find very few seaweeds. And, you know, normally you would find them around the edges of bays, but it's really dirty. And so you don't see them or don't see very many. So we're definitely having an impact.
And what about climate change and the rise of ocean temperature?
Oh, that's a big one, too, because as it heats up, a lot of the so-called bleach out on the coast, which means we've got, when the tide is out, and you think about it, these are intertidal organisms that we're mostly talking about. I mean, some of the kelps are subtidal, but then they float on the surface. Some of their fronds are sort of like leaves that photosynthesize. What happens is when the tide is out, that's what I wanted to say, is that the sun is beating down on these, so the hotter it gets, the more so-called bleaching occurs, where they turn white because they can't take the intense sunlight. So what's happening basically is it's going to move, and I think it already has started, moving species farther north, you know, sort of a migration, just like with crops on land. Things are moving to, you know, where they can grow because they release spores all the time, which is the way they do grow. There's sexual seaweeds and there's asexual. They both release spores into the environment and, you know, they can be carried a long ways away. But then they can't really grow very well if it's too hot and, you know, the sun is beating down. And if you could go out to Bodega Bay some days and you could see that it's just like white because they've started dying. I mean, it's like coral reefs, you know, they're being impacted that way too. They talk about bleaching. That's what it means. I mean, it's not really a bleach. It's just they can't take that intense sunlight.
So you mentioned coral, and I know we're talking about seaweed,
yeah,
but
there are some corals out here.
The bleaching of these things, does this mean they're dead, or does it mean they just have lost their ability to thrive?
Some could be dead if they're totally bleached. I mean, if part of it's bleached, part's going to die away, and there still could be the holdfast and a little bit of growth, and some of them will grow back. So it just depends on the species.
I'm talking with Marilyn Cannon from her home in Forestville, California, and we are surrounded by lots and lots of specimens that she has collected from all over the world. And what are some of the differences that you have found? I know you have specimens, as you said, from Newfoundland, from Hawaii, from California, and we were talking with Susan Shetterly about her book, and that's up in the Gulf of Maine, which is, I would think, a completely different environment from, say, Monterey Bay. So what do we see as some of the hallmark differences from global seaweed?
Okay, well, the farther north you go, and I've been to Newfoundland, which isn't that far from the Gulf of Maine. I've been to Nova Scotia, so I've been near there, and I know about the Bay of Fundy, which has the highest tidal range in the world, which is, I'm sure, why they're thinking of harvesting seaweeds from there, because there probably seem like there's so many, and maybe they can. But the farther north you go, the fewer species there are, but the bigger they seem to grow. And when you go to warmer places like the Hawaiian Islands, sargassum is there, by the way. But there's mostly small species, like small size, I should say, that grow mostly under the water because they can't take all that heat. So down here, there's more diversity in California, lots of species. You go up to Alaska or Newfoundland, there's going to be fewer. And there's going to be a lot of kelps, big. Well, there should be.
So let's just distinguish, and we're rapidly running out of time, but I want to say for people who walk on the beach and visit places like Bodega Bay or Monterey Bay, what are some things we can look for and maybe also distinguish kelp and other kinds of seaweeds?
Well, if you're walking along the beach, you often see what they call seaweed rack, all these pieces laying up there, and sometimes they're very fresh, and some species have been discovered that way. Somebody picked them up and said, oh, I wonder what this is, and maybe it was from 40 feet deep in the ocean. So you could see all kinds of different ones if you get there at the right time. The kelps are generally heavy, and I mean, really heavy. You pick them up, and they got this big stipe. It could be an inch or two across. Could have a big bulbous thing at the end. That's the bullwhip kelp or the Nereocystis. So you would generally tell that those are kelp. When it comes to the others, they're, as you saw, some beautiful ones. And they're laying there, and you can tell, like I said, reddish from greenish at least. And then you can see the brown kelp. So that would be one way. And they are really beautiful if you take the time to look at them. Once they start rotting away on the beach, sometimes people don't like that smell. I love it, so I'm fine with that. But there's also a lot of flies that live in the rotting kelp, which is fine. They're not, you know, like dangerous. They don't carry diseases. But they're called seaweed or kelp flies. So you'll see them as you walk by.
And I know I've always enjoyed picking up dried kelp that still has, I mean, it's mm-hmm. just so interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think we see a lot of local artists working with kelp. But if somebody wants to, you mentioned a few minutes ago to me that, oh, it's all edible or something like that. And mm-hmm. if people are walking on the beach and they see either green type kelp. I've seen green kelp wash mm-hmm. up in like little mm-hmm. almost lettuce leaves, it looks
right,
like.
Yeah, they're called sea lettuce. Sea lettuce. Yeah. Yeah, you could eat those. I mean, as long as they're fresh, take them home and rinse them off, and then you could put them in soup or whatever.
So really, we should just be adventurous with that.
Yes, you could be. And if you saw some kelp, especially the one with the big bulb and the big long bullwhip, as it's called, those are annuals. So if you found one up on the beach, you could just, I think, take it. But you can cut it up. Some people even make cakes, you know, like you would like zucchini or something like that. You have to get some of the salt out of it. But
Marilyn's wearing a shirt with an electron microscope. Is that an electron microscopic picture?
Yeah, it's called an electron micrograph. which I made in 1984 of this. This is two cells next to each other, so you can see how complicated they are. Yeah. I mean, they have the same kind of intracellular parts that most plants have, like a chloroplast and mitochondria. We don't have chloroplast, but we have mitochondria, and most people know about that. That's the energy-producing organelle.
Marilyn, in our kibitzing over your many books and stuff like that, you said that seaweed has, and I'm using that term in the, I guess, vernacular sense, since they're really not weeds, but anyway, have a complex reproductive system. So in a, for the lay person, is that something you can describe why it's so complex, or what is the complexity of it?
All right. Well, the complexity is that there are ways of reproducing non-sexually, which is called vegetative reproduction, which probably people know about, like adventitious roots on a plant would be vegetative reproduction, so that they can grow back into a clone, basically. But for mixing of genes, you know, to make them more successful in their environment, they have sexual reproduction. And so a lot of people don't realize that they have a very complicated sexual reproduction, where parts of the seaweed will make female cells and parts will make male cells. And then they get thrown out into the ocean column, and they're somehow attracted to each other, so they've got to have some sort of a hormonal attractant. I mean, it's successful, so it works. But it's complicated in that they make little tiny structures that stick out of the blade or the frond of the seaweed, so-called. Like, you're right, seaweed's not a good word, because the only reason they call them seaweeds is because they didn't like this weed on the beach. That's what. Anyway, these marine algae are very complicated in the sense that there's all different kinds of different cells that can grow back into the seaweed again. And, of course, genetic diversity is the reason behind that. So, fascinating.
And it's all around us and available to us, so good reason to take a walk out at the beach. Thanks so much, Marilyn.
You're very welcome.
I've been speaking with local phycologist and former professor at Sonoma State University, Marilyn Cannon. Earlier in the show, I spoke with Susan Hand Shetterly, and her book is Seaweed Chronicles, A World at the Water's Edge. I thank both of our guests today, along with our production staff, Sean Knight, Mark Prell, and Sean Smith. This is a production of Northern California Public Media and Lit Radio. Our music today was David Crosby and Graham Nash from their classic album, Wind on the Water. You can listen to past shows and subscribe to our podcast at krcb.org. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thank you for listening. It's a novel idea.